Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shake of a sauce bottle, mate.
Hello there, Mark Kenny with Democracy Sausage, which comes to you every week from the Australian National University. When I think of the most impressive diplomats and international players, I find the list heavily populated with women. Secretaries of State like Madeleine Albright and Hillary Clinton come to mind, Australian foreign ministers like Penny Wong and Julie Bishop, and national leaders like Angela Merkel or EU President Ursula von der Leyen. All of these, of course, have their critics, some of them really quite disproportionate, but each of them rose to their roles while being the exception to a rule in which men were considered the norm. After the right lost its composure completely over the nomination of the ANU alumni Sam Mostyn last week as our new Governor General, soon to be appointed, I thought it would be a good time to chat about women in diplomacy and positions of leadership and even in space, and not just women, but people of all gender diversity. Dr. Elise Stevenson is a Deputy Director of ANU's Global Institute for Women's Leadership, and she's a leading researcher on all of the above and much more. Her brilliant new book is called The Face of the Nation. Elise, welcome to Democracy Sausage.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on The Face of the Nation. It's a wonderful book. Perhaps maybe let's just start by talking about why you wrote that book and essentially how you went about it, what the structure of that book is, because it's very much an interview-based book, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Look, I came to this book really because as a person working in international affairs and very interested in politics and representation, I kept coming to this question of who gets chosen to represent the nation and specifically who represents Australia. Now, you mentioned a number of key figures there, Julie Bishop, of course, Penny Wong, Julia Gillard. Now, unfortunately, these have often been first and onlys, and we're only just starting to break the record when it comes to what traditionally has been a quite white male domination of men in power in these positions. So, in fact, it was actually only in 2018 that Australia got our very first First Nations female ambassador, that was Julianne Guevara. Now, that's pretty phenomenal that it took 118 years post-federation. We haven't really done a lot of the good work that we need to be doing when it comes to gender equality in our international affairs. And so this is kind of where my research in my book has stemmed from. Now, when I dug into it, I talked with global leaders across diplomacy, defence, federal policing, home affairs, across the intelligence community. And what I started to find was by analysing and kind of unpacking their narratives, experiences and stories alongside almost 40 years of longitudinal data on women's representation, I found that although we are starting to get parity or near parity in places like diplomacy, inequalities seem to evolve. So we have all these other kinds of challenges. So we tend to see, for instance, when women are posted internationally on behalf of Australia, they're generally posted to lower status countries or in lower prestige positions. Now, that matters if you're to have the authority in leadership. So we find that women are often constrained, even though they are increasingly there.
Yes, it's really interesting, isn't it? You can change the rules, and that's fundamental. You really need to do that. If we think about giving women the franchise, for instance, in Australia, you can change those rules. then it takes sometimes a long time to sort of change the cultural practices that those rules used to give expression to, those rules legitimated before. So we think about the first female entrance to the House of Representatives and the Senate, it's basically 40 years after Federation.
Yeah.
So it sort of demonstrate that there's a lot that needs to happen to drive change. Sometimes the change is happening and the rules are way behind and you get perhaps quicker progress. But, yeah, really interesting that point you make about women in foreign affairs, for example, in Australia, getting postings, but those postings being to, as you say, sort of more peripheral countries, less high prestige countries, because of course the prestige postings, the highest ones in Australian foreign policy, tend to be things like the US.
That's right. Yeah, Washington, DC, yeah. London. These are posts that we're still yet to see a woman as our most senior representative of Australia in those posts. So this is something that I would like to see certainly change, but also across the more securitized aspects of international affairs too. So while we know that, you know, Australia's diplomacy is leading in many regards globally in terms of women's representation and a lot of that kind of gendered foreign policy we're able to prosecute, we know that still in more securitized aspects of international affairs like defence, home affairs, policing, that they are lagging behind. We know that when we look at funding then, and the Lowy Institute has done quite a lot of analysis of budgeting over years, and we see that whilst diplomatic footprint has decreased over the last 40 years, we see at the same time women are increasingly in that portfolio. But when we look to security, you know, defence and home affairs, they've had a huge boost to funding. They are disproportionately receiving funding and often status and prestige that goes with our international affairs. But this is also domains that are least likely to be represented by women. So we're still looking at around 20% of the ADF as having women. So what we tend to see then is what I call a diplomatic glass cliff. Even though we've got women in diplomatic leadership, diplomacy as an institution, it is suffering, I believe, from a lack of funding, and it does need a much more central role in our Australian foreign policy. I think when we think about it, honestly, diplomacy is our first line of defence, yet we're not really seeing, I guess, that commensurate attention to the diplomatic institution. And I argue that that has gendered ramifications given, you know, the more securitised our international affairs is, it's still mostly male dominated as a result of that.
Yes, and it's not just the binary gender either, is it? Other representations of gender diverse people, different sexualities that have been essentially vastly underrepresented.
Oh, absolutely. And this is something really interesting because when we talk about the representation of gender and sexual minorities in international affairs, I often get this response of, well, why do we need more LGBTIQ+ people in international affairs? Now, that's kind of a side note to the question, which is actually we have LGBTIQ+ people in international affairs already. What have been their experiences and how are they coping in this domain? My research is some of the first globally that has gone into looking at LGBTIQ+ representation on the global stage and in diplomacy. We do tend to see very little data out there, particularly on trans and non-binary people. However, we are starting to see much more evidence around lesbian and gay people, people who identify as queer in sexuality. In some of my research, I spoke to phenomenal queer women leaders who had been effectively closeted for their 40-plus year career.
Is this in DFAT, you mean?
No, this is across the international institutions I studied. So whether that's diplomacy, defence, policing. So if you can imagine that, that is very, very difficult, particularly because our international representation often relies on, they call it kind of the diplomatic household. So you have a trailing spouse, it is called. So typically in the past, this has been you've had a male ambassador or a male defence commander who has a trailing wife who follows them and does all of the diplomatic housework that is required to maintain Australia's international representation overseas. That hasn't generally been funded as a role in the past, but it's still core to the mission. You know, there is a huge amount of negotiation, of soft skills, yes, of meeting with individuals that goes into maintaining our foreign policy, but those roles haven't been recognised. So what we tend to see now that there are more women in, you know, whether it's police commanders, defence commanders, ambassadors, in those senior representational roles, we tend to see that often their husbands aren't willing to travel with them, aren't willing to disrupt their own careers, or aren't willing to do some of that unpaid diplomatic housework. The interesting thing then is when we do happen to find queer people in international affairs, and particularly queer women, my research suggests that, well, maybe they're best equipped to do this job, because not only do we have super proficient, amazing ambassadors and commanders who are doing their great and paid work, but often their wife or their female partner is also willing to do some of that feminized labor that men typically as partners aren't so keen to do, understandably,
or aren't very good at doing.
Well, maybe.
Perhaps because they're not very good listeners in some cases. That might be
I won't comment on
no,
that.
No, you couldn't comment on that. No, well, it reminds me, actually, I remember travelling to the US with Julia Gillard when she was Prime Minister in my role as a journalist. And at the time, that was for a very high-level visit with Barack Obama. And I think at the time, her partner at the time, Tim, was very atypical, because Julia Gillard was atypical in the sense. And so you had this kind of reversal, and you go to some of those peak meetings where there are a number of leaders together, and essentially it was a whole bunch of blokes as leaders, and the spouses would have a separate program for one of the days, and it would be one male with a bunch of other women,
absolutely,
for example, because it was so gendered, it was so old school.
That's right. I mean, when you look at a lot of those big international forums and events, you know, whether it's APEC or MICTA or G20 or whatever it is, I mean, certainly there's been a number of stories of people like Julia Gillard and some of our other senior foreign ministers who've been put on the wives' bus rather than on the leaders' bus when it comes to getting transported around the country in which those events are hosted in. I mean, that's completely unacceptable.
You mean the foreign minister being put on a wife?
Yeah, or the prime minister being put on the wives' bus. The kind of institutions,
that is outrageous.
They just haven't developed in a way that is gender sensitive, right?
Yeah.
Fundamentally, they've developed or been developed for men by men, and you get very little of that gendered thinking that could really help often. But even this year, you know, I was down in Melbourne for the Australia-ASEAN Summit in March. If you look at the family photo that the leaders always do, you know, with the hands interlocked,
yes,
all of the prime ministers holding
looking
hands.
Looking awkward, yeah.
Look, there's not a woman in sight.
I know.
There's literally not a woman in sight.
So, and once you see that, right, but this is one of those consciousness-raising things, right? It is so normal that people don't notice it until it's drawn to their attention. It needs to be drawn to their attention,
absolutely,
quite a lot. But once the penny drops, you cannot unsee it. And every time you see these phalanxes of men making these decisions that are absolutely critical to the lives of others, particularly in respect of conflict, and we can talk about women, peace and security and that whole agenda as well. But once you've seen that, you cannot unsee it. And it seems so vastly and appallingly unrepresentative. Mm.
Yeah, and I think this is the really disappointing thing, because we have seen some evidence that we're seeing more backlash to gender equality. We are seeing an increasingly well-funded anti-rights movement globally. We're even seeing younger people who, I think in some surveys, a very big block of younger people believe that gender equality has gone too far, as if we have already achieved gender equality when we're so far away. And so for me, it's always this case of kind of wanting to shake people. And even if in your own personal circumstances or in the world that you see, you feel we have gender equality, I mean, you just have to look at the data, and you have to look at even just basic things like these leaders' photos to see how unequal things are. And really, I think that's so worrying, because if we have this idea that, hey, actually, we're almost there, we've already achieved gender equality, when we haven't, then that's also when we're most likely to stagnate or get backsliding when it comes to gender equality. We've already seen the erosion of abortion rights in the US. We see all kinds of anti-feminist movements globally. I think this is something we've got to pay a lot more attention to. So I'm glad we're having this conversation, to be honest.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that women, peace and security agenda, because, again, these are things that are, I think, difficult for some people to get their heads around. I think of an appalling recent example, that is the pullout of the alliance from Afghanistan. Now, Laura Bush and George Bush, way back when the invasion happened, as part of the justification for that, the emancipation of women and girls in Afghanistan who were subject to the most appalling discrimination and abuse and violence under the Taliban. When America eventually pulls out all those years later, it enters direct negotiations with the Taliban for the hand back of power and does not include women in that process at all.
Mm.
It is a classic example. Of course, this was the cohort, half of the population, that was about to become subject to the most appalling discrimination, as we have seen occur, at the hands of an agenda that the US had control of.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, when you look at things like the Women, Peace and Security Agenda, which is a United Nations Security Council resolution that came about just over 20 years ago now, this was something that was really pushed by the US. I mean, the US literally has congressional mandates that their government departments have to uphold women, peace and security principles. And this not only impacts government departments insofar as they should be gender representative and equal in leadership and in decision making, particularly around peace and conflict, but also in any kind of peace and conflict, you know, aid or development or negotiations that countries enter into, they should also make sure that women are at the decision-making table, that we've considered the ways in which women and children are, you know, disproportionately impacted, as well as LGBTIQ plus people. So it's really disappointing, basically. And I think it really illustrates how for gender equality, for women, peace and security and initiatives like this, you can turn on and turn off when you do and don't care. And it's often seen as, yeah, not that relevant. Like it's not the main game. It is secondary to our main concern here. But when we look at things like Myanmar, for instance, there's been some great research that's come out of Myanmar, and this was previous to the most recent military coup, which was really looking at what sustains the conflict in Myanmar. And, you know, a lot of political scientists and defense scholars and all different kinds of scholars had puzzled over this question. There's lots of ways to answer it. But a brilliant academic, Jenny Hedstrom, did some research and she took a gendered and women, peace and security analysis of the conflict. And she basically found, look, if there weren't women at home mending clothes, patching up injured soldiers, looking after children, cooking and cleaning, then that conflict would be impossible to maintain. So by applying a gendered lens, you actually see that the labor that women are inputting in terms of looking after soldiers and cooking, cleaning, etc., that helps to maintain conflict. Now, if you didn't apply a gendered lens, if you're not thinking through this lens of women, peace and security and how they're implicated and what their roles are, you actually then also don't see the solutions and how to effectively involve all groups. So perhaps if we had a more gendered lens to all of our world conflicts, we could perhaps even stop it before it starts.
Well, that's true. So there's that aspect of it, which putting it in a sort of a pejorative way is almost like an enabling aspect of it. But there's also the implications for that cohort of the population, that half of the population and children in conflict zones, in the mediation of conflict and how can you resolve it, how you can avoid it. Put women at the table who have those experiences and who understand the implications of families being torn apart and dislocation and so forth. Does it change things? I mean, there's evidence that it does.
Absolutely.
And if we think about Israel-Gaza at the moment, we see these negotiations going on in Qatar and other places, and we see the people who are at the table, and it's just a bloke fest.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So, you know, we do know from the data that peace processes that include women are much more likely to last, to actually involve peace. We're much more likely to see consensus and collaboration. You know, all these things that are really important. On the flip side, we know that the continuum of gender inequality and violence is really ingrained and a little bit more complex than perhaps we first realized. So I'm in a lot of national security rooms and I often hear people say things like, oh, you know, we're defense and national security folk. Things like domestic violence, that's actually not relevant to us. Yes, it's violence, but it's not relevant to national security. Well, there's been some great research actually that's come out of the Middle East, which really demonstrates that states that have higher levels of domestic violence are also more likely to use violence against their interstate neighbours. So
that's fascinating. Yeah,
you're tying then domestic violence in the home to domestic violence at a state level. For me, it really reinforces the reality that gender inequality anywhere contributes to instability and conflict everywhere. And so this is why, whether we're looking at domestic violence, whether we're looking at international representation, women in peace and security negotiations, we just have to do better. We are nowhere near what we should be doing and a gender equal world. I think just looking at the statistics around Asia Pacific, we're some 189 years from achieving gender equality in terms of political empowerment. I mean, that's too late. And that's only if we continue going at the same rate, even though we've seen stagnation and actually regression in the last year.
Going back to that point that you made a minute ago about the commonality between societies that have high levels of domestic violence also being potentially more inclined towards aggression toward neighbours, is it possible that the common thing there, rather than A being causal of B, that the common thing there is men, and that it's about men and ego and humiliation and the unwillingness to take a backward step? I know that these are tropes in a way, but they're not without they're not without truth, and this is coming from a man speaking. Is there any research that supports that?
Look, I would love to know more about that. I'm not specifically aware of this research. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. What I would say, though, is that, yes, we're looking at patterns here, and where you've got any sort of pattern of domination of a majority group, for instance, or majoritized group over another group.
And the resort to physical measures.
That's right, exactly. You are likely to see this sort of pattern replicate. I think that, I guess I've got a bit of academic freedom, and so when I think about in Australian foreign policy and in global foreign policy, we often see really highly, highly kind of calculated, very good foreign policy, which is rigorous. It's gone through great policy and planning, tested, et cetera, et cetera. What concerns me, which is related to your point, is that then we just have one megalomaniac who is likely a man who comes in and throws that foreign policy out the window.
That's an unpredictable actor or erratic
behaviour. That's it, irrational. And I don't think that our systems have really conceptualised and planned for the irrational actors and the fact that they're basically always men in these situations that can have this really grand impact on society. So this isn't to say, you know, inherently that men are more violent and dangerous and that women aren't doing this sort of behaviour as well. However, what we've seen, and whether you look at Putin or Trump or
Myanmar.
Exactly. Bolsonaro, we do see this pattern, and often more populist, often more right-wing male leaders who basically flout the rules. And I think that that has really troubling ramifications, not just for freedoms, rule of law, international rules-based order, but also for gender.
It's a reminder, really, that principles matter as much as the policies that you put in place to enact and protect those principles.
Oh, for sure.
Let's take a quick break and be back in just a moment.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Democracy Sausage. I'm talking with Dr. Elise Stevenson. Now, we were talking before about men and power and some of the dimensions or aspects of that. I mentioned in the introduction the response to the announcement that Samantha Mostyn will be the next Governor General of Australia. There was really quite an incendiary sort of response from the right and from a number of right-wing columnists, you know, accusing her of being woke. One of the charges, which I think was meant to be the one that really stung, was that this was the most political appointment of a Governor General that had ever occurred, which seemed to me to be utterly absurd. And let's bear in mind that Quentin Bryce has already occupied this role and did a fantastic job as well. So this is not the first female to occupy the Governor General's position. However, the sort of right's response has developed quite a lot since then and gathered a lot of self-confidence, perhaps because of Trump and everything else that's been going on. But we now have this whole lexicon really to draw on, talking about things being woke. She's very woke. She's represented a whole bunch of woke causes and everything else. This is the charge. What I'm interested in, though, really is your thoughts on this proposition, that really what is political about this is that it doesn't conform to the power structure, the power assumption that is embedded in those sorts of positions. So if it had been a military man, for example, there wouldn't have been a murmur from the opposition or from others. But the fact that it isn't, even though this is supposedly a modern nation and this is a perfectly constitutional appointment of an eminently qualified, highly respected Australian, nonetheless, it rubs up against that assumed norm, that status quo. So it becomes political in the pejorative just by being inconsistent with previous politics.
Yeah, that's right. I think that we do have these notions. Actually, you look at the data, and a lot of my research really found this too. Some of those most senior positions, there's a pretty well-worn track. It's often a military career and often male, but you do tend to see some of these patterns. And so when you break one or other of those patterns, you do tend to upset people. And there's kind of this idea that, no, those roles should be occupied by this kind of leader. That is the, I don't know, attributes and traits that I associate with those positions. So it can be very, very difficult if you buck that trend in any way. For me, I think that there's also an obvious gender link to this in terms of really trying to attempt to discredit and delegitimize the position and Sam's role in the position, whilst high-profile roles are always open to scrutiny and they do tend to attract a higher level of scrutiny or whatever it might be. We tend to see, and the research really backs this up, that women get more vitriolic, more personal, much more, sexist often, harassment and scrutiny and critique. And, you know, in Julie Gillard's time, for instance, there was really a pattern whereby no one, including perhaps even Julia herself, wanted to attribute that to gender. No one saw this as a gendered harassment or gendered critique or gendered backlash. However, with reflection, we can see actually it was. Some of our recent research that's also looked at very senior LGBTIQ+ politicians in Australia has also found that whilst LGBTIQ+ politicians, for instance, don't receive statistically greater online harassment, they do receive much more substantively vitriolic, personalised, and sexist, homophobic, etc., as opposed to those who are perhaps straight or non-LGBTIQ. They receive harassment, but it's much more based on policy, party, and platform. So I think that we're seeing this sort of trend carry through with Sam as well.
Yeah, so I think it's really quite telling, though, you know, that you get this kind of response in this circumstance, because there's something fundamentally democratic, it seems to me. I mean, there's not a democratic process to elect the Governor General. Unfortunately, we don't have a republic. We don't get to choose our president, whether it be through a minimalist model as was proposed in 1999 or a direct election model as some people have advocated since. What we do have is an appointment by a government, and the government has appointed someone who I think would probably have a very good chance of achieving democratic support, perhaps more so than some unknown individual from whether it be the High Court or the military, which has, you know, been the two main sources, it seems to me, of those positions. But it's really quite telling that you come along and you buck that trend and can see the sort of ramifications of it. I was interested also in your point about Julia Gillard, because I actually think that what you said is right. I do think that having, you know, covered that whole period, that Gillard herself was actually quite reluctant for a good part of her prime ministership to see things in those gendered terms. And I understand that, and I understood it at the time. I understood also why Barack Obama did not want to be defined as the black president. And I respected that position in both cases, because I think it's every individual's right to seek to be seen as, not to be identified by those sort of reductions, as it were. Nonetheless, Julia Gillard did come to that realization, and she came to it with a kind of explosive clarity, as represented by the famous misogyny speech in Parliament. And that was really the moment at which it all changed, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. And it's still a remarkable speech, which, you know, we get a lot of feedback as being an instigator, a real inspiration for leaders globally. A good example of Julia's commitment to gender equality now is with our very own Global Institute for Women's Leadership. So she is the founder and the chair of our institute. She does an enormous amount of work for gender equality. And I think that really, and this is a trend that I've noticed with my research too, when leaders are in the position that they're in, it's very, very hard both to reflect on the true circumstances of that in terms of the harassment in particular. You know, we're talking about literally hundreds and sometimes thousands of death and rape threats a day that some of our senior women leaders face. I mean, that's just absolutely unconscionable. If you were to sit
Who would want, I'm flabbergasted by this. You know, I'm aware of what you're saying and I'm not challenging it at all. I'm just appalled by it. And I always wonder who would want to be one of these people? I mean, who would want to look at themselves in the mirror and say, I'm one of these people that actually sends violent, hateful messages to strangers, to people I don't know. We see it on Twitter. We see it everywhere. I have just an imagination problem, I suppose, in trying to even understand that level of vitriol and rudeness.
Oh, it is really hard to understand. And I think with digital technologies, we do see the anonymity of a lot of these forums, and whether that's Twitter or X or any other sorts of forums, there is a kind of permissiveness that people can be their, I don't know, most unruly selves, and what you wouldn't normally say face-to-face to a person, there's a permissiveness now. But it is really challenging.
But it's kind of normalised, and what worries me.
It's normalised. It is completely normalised. Certainly we've just wrapped up some research on young gender-diverse people's pathways to politics. And it was mostly women, but we had a fair number of transgender and non-binary participants, mostly very highly engaged in politics, whether that be through activism. You know, a few had actually run for politics, you know, doing their own enterprises, that sort of thing. But we noticed that there was a huge, level of distrust in government, probably not surprisingly. But the number one concern and reason why they wouldn't pursue politics was the sexist nature of the institution and really concerns about workplace safety in Parliament. And I mean, you know, certainly we've had a rough few years in Parliament, and so perhaps that's not surprising. But I think that it's troubling that it's not just occurring in workplaces, but people can't switch off from it because your workplace all of a sudden is public domain. You might use Twitter or X or Facebook or whatever to communicate with your constituents, but you also have to then hear from them. And sometimes that can be a really difficult thing when it comes to actual harassment and abuse, which is so common.
Yeah, and a lot of people even have trouble understanding what it would be like to be the victim of that, and just seem to sort of take the view that, oh, well, just don't listen to it, don't read it, or if you do hear it, just forget about it, you know, ignore it. That's easy to say if you're not the subject of it, particularly for someone who's young, whose identity is a work in progress very much, who's stepping out into the public realm, who's probably got a great deal to offer, and who then gets absolutely shouted down by this sickening fusillade of morons, just with utter disrespect. It can be absolutely debilitating for those people. It can be devastating for them. It can see them, as you say, shun or walk away from that contribution that they were about to make. And we're all the losers for that. I don't know why anyone would be proud of that sort of behaviour. I'm astonished by it.
That's right.
And most of them wouldn't do it in public, interestingly enough. Most of the people who would hold the lift door open for you if you were rushing up to it. But then in some other dimension of their reality, they lose it. I mean, I've known colleagues and other people in, with public positions who have been quite abusive and entered into quite vitriolic, sort of exchanges with readers and critics and so forth on X Twitter and other places. And I thought, why are you doing this? Surely you could show some sort of example here. Just don't do it.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point around the example too. You know, I'm sure you'd agree that at times journalism can be, you know, it also has a role to play. Certainly it's not the only actor. However, I mean, gosh, if you think back to Julia Gillard, the media reporting at that time was also pretty appalling when it comes to kind of the gendered nature of just touting the line and really, yeah, some very, very horrible and vitriolic things said. But then even years later, I'm from Queensland originally, so seeing, you know, on the front page of, I think it was Courier Mail or other newspapers, picture of Anastasia Palaszczuk, our premier, in crosshairs of a gun. You know, at what point is that actually acceptable?
Yeah.
I suppose journalists are held by a code of conduct and perhaps some ethics. However, how does that translate when we've got the rise of social media, other forms of communication? I think we do have to think a little bit more even about the civic education side of things and what does it mean to be a good citizen? And sure, democracy is about having your voice heard, but also where's the respect? Where's the respect for Australian values of, you know, egalitarianism and freedoms and all those sorts of things? Like, there's still a lot there that we can do to be respectful of others.
Yeah, that's right. And freedom of speech should not involve the freedom to stop other people speaking with, you know, humiliation and abuse and all of that. Now, Let's talk about another area of your research, because you're obviously a very busy person. One other area you've spoken and written about is space. Now, what interests you about space in terms of this question of gender fairness?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, I kind of, because my research does span a few different domains, I try to think about the research I do is working at frontiers. So whether that's international affairs or new people entering politics or, in this case, space. I came to the topic of space, I think I was wrapping up the research for my book. I was in Adelaide interviewing Julia Gillard, and the Australian Space Agency had just been announced. So Elon Musk was in town. There was a lot of hoo-ha. It was very exciting. And I thought to myself, okay, so if we've got this brand new institution and this brand new opportunity in Australia, will it be just like all of the others and like our history of inequality to date? Or do we
Such
have a
good
fresh
question, yeah.
opportunity? Can we truly create new institutions in more gender equal times that are gender equal?
Can its baseline norms essentially be rooted in now and be progressed from here? Or will they carry the legacy of all of these problems?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, when I was listening to Elon talk and he's talking about, get this, he uses the word colonize. He's talking about colonizing Mars.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
That gives you a really good indication of where we're at in terms of repeating past mistakes. But then that made me think, well, who gets to make these decisions about whether we colonize / settle other planets, whether we mine them, what we do in terms of space? Because currently, most of these decisions, most of the funding has been driven basically by a very small Western white male billionaire type figures. And really, who gets to make those decisions on behalf of the whole of humanity?
Egomaniacs, probably.
Who benefits, right? So yeah. It's not just about who makes decisions, but who is actually reaping the benefits of that? Because I'm not 100% sure that that's going to be a very fair and equal spread. So this is really what got me into this research in space. And what I'm attempting to do is map all of the ways in which space is becoming gendered, whether that's, you know, NASA developing and sending women out for the very first international space station walk and it has to be cancelled because they don't have enough space suits to fit women, or whether that's looking at things like, you know, women are only 1 in 5 of space sector workers, looking at the funding. So we know just generally that only less than 1% of total global procurement goes to women-owned businesses. In Australia, we're talking about space economy being one of our fastest growing sectors. So where are women? And trying to place the gendered issues and the ramifications. So it's been a pretty interesting research project so far. And I think the ramifications are much more grounded on Earth than you might think at first.
Yes. Well, I suppose you could say there's no sexism on Mars at the moment, but we seem intent on making sure there is when we get there. So really it's about looking at perhaps the way these companies and these organisations and institutions are developed for this new frontier, as you describe it, whether they will have gender balance in their staff makeup, whether they will take into account gender and sexual diversity, these sorts of questions. It's open to them, isn't it? And yet we know that space exploration has been dominated by, you know, very male types of professions like engineering and mathematics, notwithstanding the fact that brilliant women mathematicians basically got, I can't remember which Apollo mission it was back, but managed to do it.
Absolutely.
You know, using a pencil and a pad because they were so bright. But that's a real challenge, isn't it? I mean, we don't see of these egomaniacal billionaires that we see strutting the globe, we don't see too many women.
No, well, that's absolutely true. Yeah, I mean, maybe things would be the same if there were, but maybe not. I mean, the fact that there aren't any or many really says something. But I think that it is interesting. So only, you know, around 10% of astronauts have been women. They were barred from the first space flight missions. We tended to see a lot of overlap in terms of that military culture informing what we do in space. But when I think about what it means in a modern global sense now. I mean, we rely on space technologies for just about everything, whether that's memory foam mattresses, whether it's firefighting equipment, whether it's Earth observations of bushfires. I mean, what really gets me is I think we need diversity in the room at all stages because, for instance, in the really terrible bushfires we had in 2020, would it have made a difference if we had more First Nations people in Earth Observations who could say, hey, that's a really important cultural area of significance there. Like, how can we actually have prevented damage through the fires? You know, if we have people in the room, that's critical. So making sure we have representative workforces, but it's not just about that. It's also about having workforces that can see the world in a particular way, who are trained, whether that is so that they're gender sensitive and they think about the ways their policies and decisions impact on genders differently, whether they are aware of First Nations principles in what it is we are doing in space and, you know, thinking about the right to a dark sky and, you know, yes, all of the cultural, yes, storytelling that's gone along
with
that.
Tell my neighbour about that, the right to a dark sky.
Right, there you go. Yeah, so there's a huge amount involved and I suppose this is where, you know, I feel that without having representation in this decision-making realm, we're setting humanity on one trajectory that could take us really far and fast in a direction we actually don't want to go.
Yeah, and replicating a problem that we already know is there. Why would we do that? Why wouldn't we take the opportunity of changing direction on some of these things?
That's right.
And also it strikes me that you think about public organisations like NASA. I mean, these are using taxpayer funds. Those taxpayers, they're taking tax money from women to make these space missions. They should be represented equally. You know, they have an equal say in that. They have equal funding of it, so why not? And it's the same with a lot of these things, whether it be in universities or other ventures that are associated with this whole new frontier, as you describe it.
Yeah, for sure. That's right. I think government does have a particular obligation and responsibility to
be representative.
Be truly representative and also to have that kind of gendered and specific decision making that helps us make the best decisions. I think for me, you know, space is a really good example, but we could also look at areas like artificial intelligence or climate action. And I think these are similarly new institutions and new domains that have a huge flux of funding going to them. They are rapidly developing, and there is the great potential that if we forget gender or, you know, other forms of diversity right now, that we head off in one direction when we need to be heading in the other, and 20 years down the track we'll, I don't know, slap ourselves and think, oh, we forgot the women, or we forgot to include First Nations communities. And quite frankly, that's just not good enough. Like, no, we do have a real obligation here and a responsibility.
And an opportunity.
That's it, the opportunity piece, because there is evidence around, you know, at least correlating more diverse teams with greater innovation potential, more kind of differing perspectives in the room can be really, really critical when we're thinking about bloody hard decisions. Mm. And actually, one of the women that I interviewed for my book, she always used to say this thing, you know, foreign policy requires a lot of hard decisions, and we need good decisions, and they're not all going to come from the same place. And I think that that's kind of the key here.
Very well put. I'm glad you came back to your book, actually, because I want to just finish with a question that's sort of more related to that. It goes to, I suppose, a number of things we've touched on here in this conversation, and that is your reflection on where Australia sits globally in trying to acknowledge and drive forward the fidelity of our representation. In other words, I'll put it in a slightly less jargonistic way, do we have enough women in diplomacy? Do we present, and are we sufficiently modern compared to other nations? I was visiting one of our ambassadors quite recently. I was very happy to be doing so. And they were saying to me how a person of same-sex orientation, and they were saying to me how pleased they were upon arriving in country and finding that there was a network already and quite a number of other country representatives who were in the LGBTI community. So do you have a sense about whether we are presenting Australia in a sufficiently modern way to the world?
Yeah, this is a good question. I think that a focus on the modern Australia is really, really critical. What I would say is that in terms of gender representation, we are pretty world leading, at least when it comes specifically to our Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So, you know, I think we're sitting at about 58% of DFAT are women, around 50-ish percent are in executive level and senior executive service positions.
That's encouraging, yeah.
It is, absolutely. And I think that this is really remarkable that we've been able to achieve it almost 40 years after women were entering DFAT as the majority of grads. That was in 1985. So it's taken a while. It's taken at least a generation to transition, but we know that the policies that DFAT implemented from 2015 onwards have largely been effective. What I will say is that DFAT isn't the only, I guess, institution that represents Australia, and this is where we really fall down. So our defence, security, even if you have a look at other domains, you know, we're increasingly seeing that whether it's agriculture or e-safety or other domains, the roles of foreign affairs is more dispersed now, even at a sub-national level. So state governments, local councils, we actually need to be ensuring that across all of those levels of representation, we're seeing that diversity, and I don't think we're quite seeing that yet. So whilst we are tracking relatively well on gender, and we're about to get a new LGBTIQ plus strategy for foreign affairs, we do need to do a lot more work when it comes to cultural diversity and First Nations diversity. And I think that globally speaking, I don't really want us to benchmark too much against other nations, because the reality exists that nowhere in the world have we achieved gender equality. So even if we are doing slightly better than other countries, still we're not there. And I think we really need to continue to push so that we can kind of maintain a leading status, but also be truly representative of who we are as a nation.
Being truly representative sounds to me like a pretty democratic project.
Absolutely.
Elise Stevenson, thanks so much. I've really loved talking to you today. It's been really terrific. Thanks for coming into the ANU studio, and really congratulations on the book. It's called The Face of the Nation, and wonderful read, and really great to talk to you. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Democracy Sausage for this week. Look forward to seeing you again next week. Until then, bye for now.